best way to explain it is to give you an example. So imagine you're on your computer, you're trying to write something, to write a blog post, and you're looking at the blank page and just nothing comes. So you're like, well, where has my creativity gone? What's going on? I don't know where to start. I have no idea, etc. You're banging your head on the keyboard and you're not able to produce anything. And you just quit, you close your laptop and you go for a walk. And all of a sudden, you have this aha moment. You're like, that's it, I got my idea. And the first way of thinking when you were in front of your laptop is focused thinking, where you're trying really hard to proactively solve a problem. The diffuse mode of thinking is when you just let it go and you let your brain do the work in the background. Another expression that's used a lot when talking about diffuse thinking is shower thoughts.
Yeah.
A common mistake when considering the focused mode and the diffuse mode of thinking is to think that one of them is better than the other, when in reality, you really need to use them in combination and to find the right balance, because you can't go to diffuse mode of thinking if you haven't given your brain enough material to chew on. So you need the focused mode of thinking where you're really trying to understand the problem, absorb information, and then you can let the diffuse mode take over to find a solution for you while seemingly your mind is wandering, but really there's a lot of work going on in the background. So that's the difference between the two, and I really encourage people to try to use both.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is with Anne Lure. She's the founder of Nest Labs, a community of people seeking to become more productive and creative while taking care of their mental health. We had some overlap at our time at Google London, and since then, she's gone on to get an MSc in neuroscience from King's College London. This was an incredibly interesting conversation all about how the brain works. After listening to this conversation, you'll understand the difference between focused and diffused learning, the common misconceptions about the brain, the importance of network thought and the concept of idea sex, how to apply the Feynman technique, what lucid dreaming is, and how she's exploring techniques to take control of her dreams. Lastly, you'll learn all about how to build a thriving community as an individual creator like she has. Make sure you checked out the podcast from last week with Jack Butcher. That was our live conversation all about monetization in the creator economy. And make sure you're subscribed for next week's episode with Nick Huber, aka Sweaty Star. He's a kingpin in the real estate game. We got philosophical and broke down his approach to investing in real estate. We'd love to hear what you thought of this conversation on Twitter. I'm at BZady and she's Antelamoon. Links in the show notes. Now let's get straight into the show. Anne Lure, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bilal.
So look, we've really crossed paths like several times, it looks like. I looked on LinkedIn last night and we have 75 mutual friends and connections. It looks like the bulk of them were from Google London because we both worked there for a while. When I came across your profile recently and saw all the amazing stuff you're working on at Nest Labs, I was like, I couldn't believe I hadn't seen your stuff previously, to be honest, because I'm normally pretty good at like finding interesting stuff and it just hadn't come on my radar. You were taking it from like a very specific angle, from neuroscience and behavior change and that sort of stuff. So we're going to dig into a lot of those concepts today. Before we get into that, it'll be great just to get a background of who you are and what you're working on nowadays.
I started my very first job was at Google in London, and then I moved to San Francisco where I looked after partnerships and marketing for digital health products, including their wearables, which very few people know about because I think Apple Watch has probably like most of the market at the moment. And I left Google about 3 years ago. I did a few things. I had a stint at trying to build a startup, which didn't work out. We broke up with my co-founder. I then joined an accelerator and I got to a point where I was honestly completely lost as to what I wanted to do. I went from having a very clear picture of what my career would look like when I was at Google to projecting myself in the future and having so many different possibilities to the point where it was paralyzing. So I decided to go back to school and I went back to university. I applied to join the neuroscience program at King's College in London, got accepted, and did that for the past 2 years, While I was studying, I discovered a concept called the generation effect that shows that by creating your own version of content or information that you're trying to learn, you will understand and remember it better. So to put that into practice, I created a blog, which became Nest Labs today, but was just a personal blog at the beginning, where every week I would blog about what I was learning at university, about how the brain works, about mental health, etc. And this blog grew into the newsletter I have today, which has about 25 subscribers and a community where we're about 1,700 people now, and lots of different products and courses. So that's Nest Labs now. It went from this personal blog to this platform for people who want to be more productive, more creative while taking care of their mental health.
I love it so much. Yeah, so 25,000 people on the email list and 1,700 in the community. And just to clarify, the community is a paid community, right? It's like $50 a year or something?
Yeah, that's it. That's $50 a year. I really want it to be accessible, but also to have a filter so it would only be people who really care about these topics and who are going to be committed to contribute and to connect and to learn from each other who would join, hence the paywall, but also having picked a price that is much, much lower than many other membership websites.
Yeah, I found that even the communities I've been a part of, that I've only started them recently, but I'm in like the Visualize Value community with Jack Butcher, Drew Riley as Trends community, which I'm in as well. And it's just, the main thing is, especially during this time over the last year, it's been amazing just to connect with so many interesting people, especially since we're all at home. So looking forward to learning more about that. Just to give a sense of scale beyond just the numbers there in terms of audience size, I know you do, your revenue is broken down into course revenue, the monthly kind of subscription for the community, and also it sounds like some coaching or consultancy work that you do. Is that still accurate? And like, what's the rough breakdown, even in percentage terms, for you nowadays?
The courses that I've done have all been included in the community. So that was part of the price of the membership. I would say the community, so including the courses, is probably like 90% of my revenue at this point, which was my goal, actually. I used to make most of my revenue from consulting. And that was, you know, that was great, but it was always the amount of money I was making was always linked to the amount of time I would put in. Mm. So one of my goals was really to try and build something that was more sustainable for myself, where I could have more leverage in terms of amount of energy I put in, amount of value that people get out of it and that I get out of it as well. So it's been slow transfer in terms of where my effort and where my revenue is coming from. And yeah, coaching is like, is really something I do now. It's completely, I'm surprised that you found it, because it's completely buried on the website. This is not something I talk about a lot, but there is a link on my website for people who really want to have a one-to-one conversation. They can book that, pay for an hour with me where I can look at the challenges that they have, or maybe share some personalized applications of some of the content I read about for exactly the problems that they have and what would be really helpful for them. So yeah, that's like probably 5%, 10% maybe of my revenue.
The only reason I brought that up is it did look like it was buried like from an old page or something. But I think it's important to bring up, because a lot of people see what you're doing, or some, like Jack was another example. I just did a live with him last week. And we talked all about monetization in the creator economy. And I think a lot of people see kind of like the end result almost. And I know for you, it's not the end result. You've got lots more you're working on. But for someone who's starting up, they see, oh, cool, I'll just start a community. I'll start a newsletter. I'm going to like, it's going to pay for all my bills. I'm going to be rich and famous and be really happy. And the truth is, a lot of the time, people like, even myself as well, we hedge when we leave a full-time job where you make a really good salary. And you leave and you say, okay, well, I'm going from X amount to almost zero. I need to bring something in. And I think sometimes it becomes such a black and white conversation where people say, oh, well, if you're doing consultancy, you're just selling your time. And, you know, understandably, long term, maybe you don't want to do that. But at the same time, for some people, like just speaking personally, I enjoy doing a little bit because I keep my skills sharp. I get to see how like startups are working. which I'm really interested in as part of what I talk about every day on the podcast. So I think it's a balance, and I think it's cool that you used it as a tool in your kind of journey as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are two quite important things that you just mentioned here. The first one is the myth of overnight success, which is completely untrue. And unfortunately, there are lots of people making money online by selling this dream to people, apparently, like, you know, a framework, a tool that you can just apply and voila, you're rich, which obviously doesn't work. And yeah, this is something I'm very transparent about, that even though I'm very happy about where I am today, this is the result of years of experimenting and failing and then learning from these failures and applying what I learned to new experiments. So I really love that you mentioned that. And the other thing about consulting and selling your time, the reason why I still do it is because this is also a gift from my audience. Having 1 hour with someone who reads my content and who can tell me directly, look, this is what I found most interesting, and these are the aspects that I want to apply into my life. Or sometimes these are the things I thought were fascinating, but I have a hard time finding an actual application that I can use myself. Can you help me? And then I can go back to some articles and edit them and improve them based on some conversations I have during coaching sessions. So even though the financial transaction goes one way, the value goes both ways.
Having that two-way conversation, once you've got to your size where you've got thousands and thousands of people reading, or tens of thousands, maybe, actually, I'm assuming your blog has even more than that, because if on your email list you've got 25,000, what's the rough amount of people that come on your site?
Well, I haven't checked for a long time, but I'd say probably like 50,000, 70,000 a month, something like this.
Of course, that many people, and it's very personal stuff that's going to help you. So it's the sort of stuff that someone reads and wants to speak to the person who wrote it. So I'm sure your inbox is really crowded. So before we go into kind of some of the concepts that I loved from your work, I do want to talk a little bit about your background and landing in London. I love this tweet that you shared about your culture from both your parents. So you said you've got a French dad and an Algerian mother, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like you grew up in France though.
Yes. Yeah. I grew up in France. I've always had, this, you know, living in between these two cultures, you know, just looking at the table, the dinner table, what we would eat. It was always so interesting to have couscous and Algerian pastries, but also a bottle of wine and French cheese, all of that on the same table.
The best of both worlds, yes.
Oh, yes.
I read you said, in my dad's culture, it's rude not to finish a plate. It means you didn't appreciate the food. In my mum's culture, it's rude to finish your plate. It means the chef didn't serve you enough food. And I know exactly what you mean, because I'm Pakistani. So in my house, if you've eaten it all, they'll be putting more on your plate. So it's definitely a similar culture there.
That's a mistake that lots of my French friends who had dinner at my place made, where my mum was making food. They would just finish everything because, you know, as I mentioned in the tweet, that's the polite thing to do for them in French culture. And my mom would just keep on putting more and putting more, and they would leave the table completely dead. And I was like, oh, well, now you know. Next time you know what to do. Just leave a little bit in the plate.
I'm curious if we hone into London specifically, because I'm from London. I think you might even live in East London, where I'm from as well.
Yes.
We definitely come from similar worlds. But I'm curious, like, why London? What made you come back to London after being in the States for a while? Maybe a part of that was your college university education, but I'm curious why you picked there versus Paris or somewhere else.
Well, things have changed a lot with like the current events, but at the time when I left San Francisco, I wanted to come back to Europe to be closer to my family, but I also wanted to be part of an international scene. And at the time, London was still the place to be when it came to tech and startups in Europe. First, because of the language, the fact that English is the first language means that people can come from all around the world and work there and use English as their communication language. And the second thing was culture. In French culture, for example, and here things are changing lately for the better, but there used to be lots of admin to start a business. Everything is complicated. Everything is slow. There would be lots of help for traditional small businesses, but not much for startups. Yeah. So comparing Paris to London, at the time, London was the choice that made the most sense. That's why I went back to London and not to Paris.
No, I miss London, especially this last year. It's the longest I've been away from London, and obviously missed the family and everyone, but also just it's a very unique city. I think New York is the closest we get in the States anyway, because we've got, you know, crazy cultures coming together. But there is something very unique about London because it's not America, and because of that, there's a certain international vibe that you don't get here. So anyway, that's cool. I'm glad you're enjoying it there. So let's go back to leaving your job full time. I know that it sounds like you landed in going back to university. Just take me back to that time and what you thought about and like making that decision, because you seem like quite a thoughtful person. It's not like you just said, oh, I'm just going to go and do this. You probably had maybe even a framework that you worked through.
Yeah, I didn't have a framework per se, but I really tried to go back to first principles when making this decision. And I felt like because I was completely lost in terms of long-term goals, mission, etc., I wanted to go back to something I would be happy to work on and wake up in the morning, even if I wasn't sure about the destination. And for me, learning first is something that I love doing for the sake of it. Even if there is no outcome, just the process is enjoyable to me. And second, the brain has always been something I've been fascinated with, both for personal reasons. I've had people in my family that have suffered from brain diseases and mental health challenges, but also from just a pure curiosity point of view, the fact that we have this level of consciousness, that we're able to have these thoughts, that we're able to connect them together, that we're able to communicate the way we communicate together, has always been really fascinating to me. So by combining these two things, the fact that I loved learning, the fact that I've always been curious about the brain, I decided to go back to school and study that, because I felt like, honestly, whatever happens, I will enjoy the process of studying the brain.
That sounds so simple, but a lot of people, I think, overcomplicate things and they let their ego get the best of them and say, I need to be doing this by this age. And sometimes it's just a matter of like leaning into what you truly enjoy day to day and the process, not just the outcome. So I'd love to go into the flywheel of your business in a little bit more detail. I've seen you post this tweet, and if you're watching on YouTube, this will be overlaid on the screen so people can see it as well. But just talk to me a little bit about how you see the growth of Nest Labs and how the different pieces come together.
Yeah, I have a pretty simple model for Nest Labs. So there's the website where this is the place where people come across my content for the very first time. And then there's the newsletter. So that's already a higher level of engagement. Out of the people subscribing to the newsletter, a fraction joins the membership. And then out of the people joining the membership, another fraction is probably going to take a course or purchase some additional content. And as to today, that's the highest level of engagement. I'm going to just like go back a little bit, because that's not even necessarily the highest level of engagement. I have people who haven't necessarily purchased a course of something or something like this, but who are actively organizing events and contributing to the community, contributing content and helping each other. I think to me, that's actually the highest level of engagement in terms of like participating in Nest Labs as a platform.
Because you're actually speaking to people face to face and like communicating regularly, you mean?
Yeah, there are so many content creators who are writing for a bunch of faceless readers. Having the opportunity to actually talk to people, know their names, their face, the sound of their voices, what they like, what they dislike, their dreams, their questions, etc., is such a deep level of engagement when it comes to being a content creator.
Are there other things, like have you done many live events? Have you found that to be something where, I guess your course is a kind of a form of live event, but have you done anything else like that?
Yeah, at the very beginning of last year, I did one in-person event and then we switched to online. And we have lots of live events every week, actually. Most of them are led by other members of the community. Mm. So the course was live. That was a cohort-based course. And every week there are workshops, there are meetups, there are presentations, there are Q&As where we invite experts to talk about whatever area of expertise they have. Like recently we had Steph Smith who came in to talk about newsletters. And yeah, there's lots I really like for this community, the balance there is in between asynchronous conversations. So if you don't have time to engage into all of these live events, you can still have asynchronous conversations on the forums. And whenever you have time, you can come and chat in person with everyone.
We're going to move on shortly to some of the concepts that you've been writing about. But before we do that, I'd love to understand, if you were starting Nest Labs again today in 2021, are there things that you would do differently if you were trying to start from scratch? Let's say no one knows who you are, you've got these ideas in your head and you want to get that out to people and essentially build what you've built. Are there things that you do differently to what you did a couple of years ago?
I guess the main thing is, from a technical standpoint, I would have probably spent a couple more weeks thinking about how can this grow. At the same time, it's really hard to know, and it's always like, you know, in hindsight, obviously, you know, you're going to say, I'm going to do that differently. At the same time, I think it was a pretty good thing that I didn't worry too much about the technical side of things. And I just went like, okay, blog, WordPress, MailChimp, let's launch this newsletter and let's do it. But the other side of that coin is that today I'm paying a little bit for this, where I have this technical debt. Like, I obviously went with the simplest solution possible at the moment, but it's not the same to write for 100 people than it is to write for 25,000 people. So I'm kind of like progressively going back to the tech side of things and trying to make it easier, more sustainable, like for me to manage in general. So that's probably one thing. And a second thing would probably I would have started probably a little bit earlier to create two-way conversations with people. I waited for quite a few months, it was just me sending the newsletter. And I'm getting so much value from both having one-to-one conversation with people and connecting them together, connecting readers together so they can learn from each other, that I probably would have started earlier. But I felt terrified at the time, because starting a community is not the same thing as running a newsletter either. So yeah, that's just something I would have done, like having more confidence and launching the community earlier.
I love that you just brought up the skill set in, you know, writing a newsletter versus a community, because, you know, they're essentially two different types of people a lot of the time. And some people can do both, but like running a community, a lot of it is like engaging with people, like, you know, connecting people, that sort of stuff, and answering questions. Whereas writing can be very much a solitude, something you do yourself, and let me focus for a week and write this out beautifully. So I'm curious, like, would you classify yourself as an introvert or an extrovert?
Both.
Yeah, I think we all have like a part of each, but okay. And by that definition, my definition being like, you get energy by being around with people. I don't, and you might correct my definition of this, but is that how you'd define it as well?
Yes, I'm both. I'm definitely more of an introvert than an extrovert. So that's why I think for me, working online is such a good balance, because I get to connect with people and feed the extrovert, but I also have complete freedom to finish a Zoom call and just then be on my own and go read a book. Yeah. Whereas I, you know, whenever I go to in-person events, like where I present on stage or something like this, like that part is fine. But then when I have to be in the room and mingle and what they call networking, I'm so bad at it. I'm so uncomfortable. And very often after 30 minutes, I'm like, can someone get me out of here? Can I go home?
I just thought I'd bring that up, because I feel like a lot of the time when people are trying to create something, they will replicate what other people do. But I think it's very important for people to understand what they're good at, what they naturally enjoy. And if, for example, someone doesn't like answering tweets like we both do, it's, you know, probably not worth you spending time writing on Twitter every day, you know. So I think you have to kind of find the balance there.
Yeah, and you're touching upon another thing that I think is quite important when you're making the distinction between being an extrovert or an introvert, is the one-to-one versus the one-to-many interactions. So, you know, that's why I told you, like, one-to-one, I could spend hours talking with someone, having an interesting conversation. I absolutely love doing this, grabbing coffee with a friend or grabbing a glass of wine and just like jamming for hours about the world. But I get much more tired if I'm in the middle of a group because I feel like I have to, you know, divide my attention between different people and trying to stick to the flow, etc. So that's quite interesting too. Like, you know, you mentioned Twitter. Some people are very uncomfortable with it because even though you may look like you're having a one-to-one conversation, this is a one-to-many one where at any moment someone can jump into the conversation, add something, etc., which can be anxiety-inducing for people who are not comfortable with one-to-many conversations.
So we'll move on to the next section here. The last question I had before we do that is on kind of long-term monetization, because that was something I did a deep dive with Jack Butcher on. So if you're listening to this, that would already be out by this point. We talked about the evolution from, let's say, Tim Ferriss, who wrote for millions of people with a $10 book, to the 1,000 true fans, Kevin Kelly, to Legion 100 true fans, where you can, you know, maybe charge for a course and monetize at a greater level. How do you see that evolving for you over the next few years?
I'm probably going to stay on that spectrum, which is a great framework, by the way. I'm probably going to stay on the side of the Tim Ferriss lower price point, just because I get a lot of joy and energy from knowing that I'm helping lots of people. And I know that for Nest Labs, for example, I have lots of members who live in Asia and other in Southeast Asia, India, and other countries, or South America, etc., where the purchasing parity is not the same as in Europe or North America. And I personally, and I think all of these work, but personally, it brings me joy to know that I have people writing to me and telling me, thank you so much. This is the first course I'm ever taking online because this is the first one I can actually afford. This is the first community I'm joining for the same reason. So I think I'm going to stay at that price point. That being said, I really respect also other creators. Like I know that Tiago Forte, David Perel, etc., can't remember, last time I checked, it was like $3,000 for the course or something like this. So it works, the business model works. And I do believe that if someone is willing to pay $3,000 for a course, it's probably because they can afford it and they place a lot of value on it. So, you know, any model works. But for me, the Tim Ferriss one is the one I'm probably going to pursue.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to see what you do. I could see you writing a book. I could see you evolving the community, maybe both of those things. But really, you've got a great angle to attack the world's problems with. So I'm excited to see that. So let's move, talking of which, let's move on to the second part, which is what we call behind the mind, which is very fitting for for this section. It's always called behind the mind, but this is the most relevant it's ever been. We're going to talk about some of my favorite posts of yours and just break down some of those ideas. So I thought the best way to start was talking about learning how to learn, because this kind of is an umbrella that helps everything else. So maybe we can just start off by, in that blog post, you talk about focused versus diffused mode. Focus being when you're learning, you've got like one task you're doing, versus diffused where you're letting your mind wander. Could you just like elaborate on what that means and how that fits into the whole kind of a concept of learning how to learn?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a framework that was created by Barbara Oakley, a researcher from the US. And I think the best way to explain it is to give you an example. So imagine you're on your computer, you're trying to write something, to write a blog post, and you're looking at the blank page and just nothing comes. So you're like, well, where has my creativity gone? What's going on? I don't know where to start. I have no idea, etc. You're banging your head on the keyboard and you're not able to produce anything. And you just quit. You close your laptop and you go for a walk. And all of a sudden, you have this aha moment. You're like, that's it. I got my idea. And the first way of thinking when you were in front of your laptop is focused thinking, where you're trying really hard to proactively solve a problem. The diffuse mode of thinking is when you just let it go and you let your brain do the work in the background. Another expression that's used a lot when talking about diffuse thinking is shower thoughts.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, these thoughts, you're showering and all of a sudden you're like, oh, and I know another creator, Ali Abdal. I love that he has a waterproof notepad in his shower.
I saw that on his video. That's hilarious.
I love it. Because yeah, whenever he has a thought in the shower, he can just write it down and have it later. So a common mistake when considering the focused mode and the diffuse mode of thinking is to think that one of them is better than the other, when in reality, you really need to use them in combination and to find the right balance, because you can't go to diffuse mode of thinking if you haven't given your brain enough material to chew on. So you need the focused mode of thinking, or you're really trying to understand the problem, absorb information, and then you can let the diffuse mode take over to find a solution for you, while seemingly your mind is wandering, but really there's a lot of work going on in the background. So that's the difference between the two, and I really encourage people to try to use both.
Yeah, I love that, because it's that feeling of like you're focused and it's kind of tense, and you're, you know, like there's this tension, and then you relax, and that's when some of those things kind of come together and you connect the dots. So I love that distinction. And then I also read you talked about sleep, which I think, you know, of course, like sleep is incredibly important. We know that. And if you're listening to this, so you want a whole deep dive onto that, you can go back a few episodes with Matteo, the founder of 8Sleep. We talk all about the importance of sleep. But as it relates to learning, how does sleep like play a role in that?
There's lots of research showing that when we sleep is when we consolidate our memories. So if you don't have enough sleep, you're not giving your brain enough time to consolidate everything you learned during the day. So that's one thing, which I think lots of people are aware of. The second one is just the fact that memory formation is dependent on lots of things, including attention, motivation, your levels of energy, your mental health. This is something we were talking about with Nest Labs members just this morning, where I hear people saying, I have such a bad memory. And I'm like, no, you don't have, there's no such thing as having a bad memory or a good memory. Memory is flexible. It changes. It fluctuates during the day, throughout your life. And that also means that you can impact it. You can modulate it based on how you take care of yourself, your activities, your mood, etc. So another thing where it's more indirectly linked, obviously, if you lack sleep, you're going to feel less motivated. You're going to struggle more to hold your attention while trying to learn something. It's going to have an impact on your mental health. And all of these factors are going to impact the way you learn. So yeah, folks, get enough sleep.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that is quite interesting, because if you just think back to your university years, maybe this time round, I don't know, maybe you were a lot more responsible with it, but I can just speak from experience from everyone I know. Like the first time around doing this when I was 18, like we were not sleeping. Like you're sleeping like 4 hours a night, sometimes 5 hours. I also love the fact that you said forget learning style. This was interesting to me because it's something I've only like scratched the surface of. And we hear about auditory learning styles, visual learning styles, etc. But you said that it's not as simple as that. So could you elaborate on why you say that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of dubious literature that says that people have a particular learning style. So you may be more visual, I may be more auditory. They even have the kinetic one, which is apparently learning through touch, right? And there is so much money that is being spent by you know, departments of education, by governments, to get kids to take a test at the beginning of the class year to find their own learning style. But there's zero research showing that that's the case and that people have a different style. What people have, which is completely different, is a preference. Mm. You can enjoy the process more if you use, like, you know, an audiobook versus learning. You can enjoy the process more. But whether you do it one way or another is not going to really have an impact as to how well you learn. So while it is important to enjoy the learning journey, it is also important when you look at scientific research when it comes to learning to not take shortcuts, because if you take shortcuts in explaining the science, you also make shortcuts in applying the science. So that's the distinction that I'm making, and I think is quite important. It also means that because it's a preference in terms of how you enjoy it, that can change. Your preferences change over the course of your life. You may enjoy eating a certain things at a point in your life and then you hate it later, right? You may enjoy taking walks and then that's not your thing anymore. with learning styles, that's the same. You don't really have a learning style. You have a learning preference. It means that instead of having the fixed mindset of telling yourself, oh no, I can't learn with audiobooks, or I can't, you know, learn in this way. Instead, tell yourself, this is the way I enjoy learning at the moment, but that may change. So you can keep on exploring different ways of learning throughout your life.
Like for me, I've realized now that I can listen to like literally 6 hours of podcast a day if I wanted to. And if they're conversational, I can follow them. If it's someone reading a book, it's very difficult for me to follow. And that's just like, you can, that's a nuance of like, they're both, you know, listening, but one is a conversation and one is just someone reading to me. I love the way you said, like, just explore those things, because also tools change. Like audiobooks are very popular now when they weren't when we first went, well, when I went to university the first time around. So I really love that. I think that's a great lesson to take. The last part of this is really about doing the work and staying focused and not procrastinating, which we all suffer from. And you had three things you mentioned here. One was the Pomodoro technique, two was chunking, and then three was process versus product. So why don't we just go into those really quickly? I think Pomodoro, a lot of people would have heard of, but for those who haven't, like, what is that and how should people use that?
Yeah, Pomodoro technique, very famous, as you said. It's just putting a timer on, 25 minutes of work, 5 minutes of break. And it's very efficient because it kind of helps in putting yourself in the zone. You know that as long as you don't hear the timer, there's no checking Twitter or getting distracted. And it's short enough that it's sustainable. You're not going to struggle to keep your head down and work for 25 minutes. And it's been found through a lot of experimentation by the creators of the Pomodoro technique, who found that 25 minutes was the perfect amount of time. So I really like this. And I've actually seen people the past few months who get together on Zoom and they do co-working sessions with like a shared Pomodoro timer. They're like, okay, silent, everyone works. And then 5 minute break where everyone can chat, make coffee, etc. So I think this is an amazing application.
Love that. I've got mine here. If you can see, this was, it's not actually 25 minutes, but it was from Tom's Shoes. They sent it to me a long time ago. But yeah, it's, I keep that on my desk. One, because it like looks kind of cool, but also sometimes I'm like, okay, I'm looking at Twitter every 20 seconds, and like gives me the time to just focus. That kind of links in a little bit with the next one, which is chunking. Could you just explain what you mean by that?
Again, an example can be helpful, but you know, when you're trying to remember a phone number, there's just a limit to the number of numbers, sorry, that you're going to remember. For most people, it's 7 numbers. But what they found is that if you chunk that big piece of information into smaller pieces of information, it's going to be much easier to remember. I think intuitively, lots of people know that, that instead of, you know, trying to learn a whole chapter at the same time, just take different concepts, break it down. That's chunking, basically, just breaking it down into smaller pieces of information that are easier to remember.
And then the last one was really about process versus product, which we touched on a little bit earlier. But like, why is that so important for actually getting the learning done in this case?
Yeah, I feel like lots of people focus on the outcome and forget that when it comes to learning, there are lots of aspects that are out of your control. Your environment, your schedule, just life happens, you can get sick, etc. So instead of focusing on the outcome, it's much more useful to focus on the process, on the journey. So that's why process versus product. It also means that it's easier to organize your schedule, because instead of having this big, massive goal in the end, you can just be like, okay, what's the process? What are the repeatable steps that I can take every day that are going to, whatever happens, bring me closer to the goal? So focusing on the process and tweaking it as you go, as you know, I mentioned earlier, big fan of experimenting, learning from your mistakes, etc. For me, that's really what focusing on the process is about.
Yeah, I think especially in creative work, like so for me, like the podcast is a creative process, but there is an end goal, right? Like I'm trying to create something and get people to listen to it. And naturally, I'm like a numbers driven business person. So that part of my brain takes over and says, how am I going to grow this? How am I going to share this with 1 million people? Whatever. And like, but the other part of me is kind of like the artist who loves the craft, and it's really difficult to kind of find the fine line. Do you have that struggle yourself as well?
I definitely have it sometimes, but I catch myself and I try to go back to the craft and the process. But I do have it, especially by working online on the internet and the open, where you can't help yourself from comparing your work, your success to the one of others. So I see another creator and I'm like, wow, they're so successful. This is amazing. How can I get there? But then I really try again to catch myself and I tell myself, Anne-Laure, go back to the process. Trust the process. I know it's a cliche to say this, but it works. And to me, for example, if I have managed to grow my newsletter to where it is today, it's not because I gave myself a goal of 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 subscribers. It's because I gave myself the goal of keeping on showing up every week and to send a newsletter every week. That was the goal. That was the process. And then the product, the outcome, was where the newsletter is today.
It also comes from Amazon, Jeff Bezos. They have this thing about input goals versus output goals, which is like similar to what you said. It's not about the number of people necessarily that signed up and read, because a part of that is out of your control. The input was, I'm going to write a really great piece of content every week. I'm going to keep putting on Twitter and do the process that you said. And I find that is the only way to really stay focused long term, because otherwise that part of your brain completely takes over, for sure. On the idea of learning how to learn, I love this idea of the Feynman technique. And this was cool because it's, you know, one of my favorite books as well is about Richard Feynman. And you took this idea of the Feynman technique, and it's something that people can use to remember things.
The general idea of the Feynman technique is to try and explain something that you're studying to a child. And the reason why it's so powerful is that we tend in the learning process to lie to ourselves. We tell ourselves, oh yeah, I get that. I completely understand. And one of the most obvious ways we do this is when we use jargon and complicated words in the way we take our notes or explain to someone, because this is a way to hide that we don't really understand the underlying concepts behind these complicated words. So the Feynman technique is really about writing down the easiest, simplest, clearest explanation about a topic that you're trying to understand, imagining that you're going to give that explanation to a young child. And you really have to make the effort to replace any complicated word with the clearest and simplest explanation. And anytime there is still something complicated there, to be honest with yourself and ask yourself, do I actually understand what I'm writing about here? It's extremely powerful because understanding something makes it easier to remember. And again, it makes use of what I mentioned earlier in our conversation, the generation effect. Creating your own version of something makes it easier to remember as well.
Again, now I understand that concept. Looking at how I've understood things the best was when I actually taught other people, right? Because you learn something in a lecture or at work, and then when someone says, hey, can you teach me what this means, you have to actually like audit what you really know. I have the three steps here anyway. The first part was about pretending to teach the concept to a child, jargon free. The second one was filling your knowledge gaps, because I think once you share that out with someone in that way, you're going to say, okay, I thought I understood this, but there's this section missing. And then the last part was crafting the story. So that way you're able to actually articulate that more clearly. I also like the idea of reading this out loud. It's something that came up with Polina Maranova in a recent interview where I asked her about her writing process. And she said she reads stuff out loud because it allows her to see where there's gaps or something doesn't make sense. How important is reading something out loud in retaining and understanding information from what you understand?
I think it's always helpful to look at content and information in different formats. So, you know, writing it down, saying it out loud, listening to it, that's going to be different opportunities for your brain to consume that information in different formats. So I do think it's beneficial, but that's only intuition on my part because I haven't read research on it. But okay, now you're making me curious. I am definitely going to check that out. I intuitively feel like that's probably helpful. And that's my experience as well. I think, you know, this is why usually when I'm preparing to give a speech or something like this, I'm pacing in the living room talking to myself, and lots of people do this. And if I was just reading the content of my speech on my laptop in my head, I would probably struggle a little bit more to remember it.
The concept of like visualizing you doing it, that sounds kind of woo-woo to a lot of people, but like, you know, it sounds woo to someone when you're saying visualize your future, right? And that's fine if people want to do it or they don't. But I think when you're actually visualizing giving the speech or giving the pitch or whatever it is you're working on, I think that makes such a huge difference. And, you know, because you're kind of walking through what that's going to be like. And when you're in the mode, you've already kind of almost like half experienced what you're doing at that time.
It's so interesting you're mentioning this, because talking about potentially woo-woo stuff and public speaking, I'm currently reading a book about lucid dreaming. Yeah. And the example that they give is that lots of people apparently use lucid dreaming, which is waking up in your dreams and controlling your dreams, to visualize themselves giving a speech in public. And they do that several times to the point where then they don't feel that fear of public speaking anymore when comes the time to actually do it in person. I'm still reading the book, and I need to read the original papers to see what the methodology was and if that's the case. But I don't know, I find that there's something interesting to that, to prepare yourself for a real life event by mentalizing it.
Yeah, I've heard of lucid dreaming from my brother, who's been like into this in the past. Have you experienced it yourself, or is just really you're reading about it for the moment?
I tried it. I did manage to wake up in one dream last month, which was interesting. I couldn't control it yet, but just that moment of saying, oh, hey, I'm in a dream, and which had never really happened to me before. So I'm very early in the process. I don't know if I want to push too hard on it, because from what I've read online, people who do practice it regularly have a really hard time sleeping afterwards because they don't get into deep sleep as much as before since they keep waking up. So I don't know if I want to really go that far, but it was kind of fun to experiment with it to see if that was even possible in the first place.
Yeah, it seems like such a crazy concept that you're... Because we always hear that you have hundreds of dreams, and again, I don't know if that's actually true, but like I remember like once every week maybe. And so I'm just curious, like, even from your amateur point of view so far reading the book, like, what was the process of you having or attempting to kind of intercept that thought?
So basically with lucid dreaming, you're training yourself to recognize when you're in a dream. And that takes, there are two main things that I did that are explained in the book. The first one is during the day to ask yourself, am I in a dream right now or not? And that sounds stupid, but it's not, because you're like, no, I'm not in a dream. Okay, but why? What tells me I'm not in a dream? And I'm like, okay, I'm not in a dream because, for example, I look behind me and I have my books, and I'm like, my books are here and they seem to be in the same order. I put them in, nothing has changed. That doesn't look weird. Probably tells me that it's real. I'm not in a dream because right now I can, you know, look around me. And basically just being more intentional of kind of like questioning reality and dreams and saying, okay, I can recognize what reality is. And then the second part is to keep dream journals. So when you wake up in the mornings, you write down your dreams while you're still half awake, which I've been doing. And after a while, you look at your entries and you ask yourself, this time, the opposite question. What makes these dreams? What are things that happen in these dreams that should tell me that that was not real? And, you know, you're like looking at this and you're like, yeah, I'm making this up, but there was a unicorn flying in the sky. Okay, that's a good sign that that was probably a dream. Or this weird thing happened, that's a good sign. So by doing this, you're training yourself to notice these things. And that's what happened to me when I managed to wake up finally. I had this moment saying like, wait a minute, this thing that's happening, that could not happen in reality. So I'm in a dream. So that's the process.
Thanks for sharing that. First of all, I'm definitely interested, and I'm kind of scared too, because I feel like my dreams might be crazy. So I don't know how much I want to deal with that. It's kind of how I feel about psychedelics. Like I haven't really experimented with psychedelics, though it's something that intrigues me. I'm curious, if you don't mind me asking, have you ever explored that world, especially given your background in neuroscience and stuff like that?
I did in the past. We even had a meetup about psychedelics at Nest Labs where everyone came. Yeah, no, that was really cool. Everyone shared their experiences. It was really interesting to see the spectrum of uses and experiences. We had people in the meetup who were using LSD for microdosing to be more creative and more productive during the day. Other people who were trying to foster these deep, meaningful experiences to really explore their spirituality. And there was everything else in between. There were also, you know, people from the previous generation who went quite hard on psychedelics in the 60s and 70s and who now had stopped, but in the meetup shared all of their experiences. That was a fascinating conversation, which we didn't record because I wanted everyone to feel safe considering that it's illegal in lots of countries. So we didn't record it, but I learned so much from everyone.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I think it's definitely an emerging field where a lot of the stigma goes away and people start to test things in a more scientific way. I mentioned something there, which was about a thought that I had, which was that we have many dreams per night, right? But this is just something I've heard. I don't even know if that's true. And you actually wrote a great post on the neuromyths debunking 5 misconceptions about our brains. I wrote 5 misconceptions, but yeah, it's about these myths about the brain. And I thought this would be great to go through because I think right now there's so much research happening and we're seeing real research proving or disproving things that we've heard for generations. I'd love to go through a few of those just to understand your take because you've done more research than the most people. So the first one I saw was about we only use 10% of our brain. That's something I've heard since childhood.
That's the biggest one and Limitless, I think.
Oh, I haven't seen it, but yeah, I've heard of it.
Okay, so there were so many movies. This one, other movies that have been using this concept of 10% of our brain. I think someone said something that was along those lines, but that was more of an expression. And then people started using it. I think the reason why it became so popular because there's something seducing to the idea that whatever our current capacity is just 10% of what we could achieve in the future. So I think that's why lots of people love this idea, which is completely false because, well, the whole brain is being in use all the time. And the most simple way to explain this and to explain why that's the case is because our whole body is an efficiency machine. It's trying to do as much as possible with as little energy as possible. And our brain at the moment is already the part of our body that is using the most energy. That would make absolutely no sense that it would use all of that energy just for 10% of its capacity. If that was the case, it would just be smaller, so it would use 100% of whatever the size that it is. So we are currently using 100% of our brain. Obviously, not all parts are activated exactly at the same time. And you have different brain networks that are activated for different states, different activities, etc. But no, the concept of limitless, where tomorrow you can take a pill that will bring you from 10% to 100% and you become the super intelligent being, is a myth.
Maybe Neuralink is the closest we'll get with an actual chip inside our brains. But so that's interesting. I'm just thinking from my point of view where I might have heard it, and I guess I definitely agree. It's like quite a seductive idea because it makes us feel like, oh, I've only reached 10% of my potential and there's so many more things I can do. The next one was around left brain versus right brain. And I think, again, like we talked about earlier with introvert, extrovert, it's not necessarily so black and white. So we have both in our brains, I guess. So like what's the myth there that isn't actually true?
Some people think that there's one side of the brain that is more creative, the other one more analytical. And all of modern neuroscience shows that this is pretty much teamwork for the brain. Everyone is participating. Another thing that's quite interesting too is that the brain is highly plastic. And there have been studies that show that when a particular function is damaged in one side of the brain, the other side of the brain is just going to take over that function, which shows that there's no particular area of the brain that is in a fixed way dedicated to one particular function. So yeah, and that's something that's also that caught on and that is so popular. People say I'm more left-brained or right-brained. which is not a thing. You're not more right brain or left brain. So yes, there are functions that naturally sit more in, that sit in the left part of the brain, functions that sit on the other side, but you're not more right brain or left brain. Everyone is using both of those sides. Yeah.
The last one on that is just around IQ tests. IQ tests just tell us how good you are at IQ tests. That is also a myth.
Yeah, this one is quite controversial, and I actually got lots of emails from angry readers when I published this one, because again, it is quite a seducing notion that we're all equal, that everyone is the same, and I'd love for it to be the case, but it just isn't. And there are lots of large scale studies. There are some countries, I think it's Sweden, there are some countries that actually administer an IQ test to everyone who joins the army, which has allowed some scientists to perform research on literally dozens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. So I'm talking like really large scale studies where it's kind of hard to fake significance of the results. And they found that IQ was correlated to lots of different things. In particular, the one I thought was the most fascinating was the life expectancy that was correlated to IQ. And the higher your IQ, the longer your life expectancy.
That's kind of crazy. I mean, I would need to read that. But you said that was a correlation. So obviously not causation, because that would be crazy to be able to even prove causation for something like that.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Do you feel like it could be just the correlation is, like, do you think that's a significant correlation for it to be?
My feeling is that it does make sense to me, in the sense that if you have a lower IQ, you may make decisions that are less beneficial for yourself. So I think there was another study that showed that people with a higher IQ tended to smoke less, I think, for example. So I think it does make sense. Like,
yeah,
if IQ, yeah. But what we haven't proved though is that IQ measures intelligence. So what we know is that we measure something called IQ. What is it? We generally don't know. We call it an intelligence quotient, but that's what we called it. We measured that thing called IQ, and we know that it's correlated to life expectancy, to behaviors. You tend to have more dangerous behaviors with a lower IQ. Does it mean that you're more intelligent, that you're smarter, etc.? I don't really know. And that's the part that's interesting. And I think that's where the confusion comes from.
Yeah.
Because the definition of IQ is not necessarily what we named it.
There's an oversimplification to say someone with a high IQ is very smart. Like, yeah, of course, on the IQ scale, they're smart. And that is something significant, but it doesn't necessarily talk about their EQ or, you know, other things that we might refer to as being smart. I guess it's just these broad terms that are the problem here, because, you know, but that's one side is like oversimplifying. And then the other side is people just wanting everything to be equal when they're not necessarily equal. You know, like there are different levels of intelligence, obviously, between different people. And I think that's a difficult concept to discuss. I hope we don't get cancelled for this.
No, and I want to add something else too, is that another explanation for IQ, for example, is that, you know, it is a scale that was devised in a way that measures what some people at a specific point in time thought was conventional intelligence. So really what it shows is that people who have a higher score at a test that was devised to measure a very specific type of conventional intelligence tend to make more conventional decisions that are safer for themselves and tend to live longer. When you put it this way, it's really not controversial.
Yeah, no, that's completely, that makes that rational sense. No, thanks for sharing that. I think that's interesting. I think there's another 10 we could go through, but for the sake of time, I think those are a few common ones we've all heard about. The next one I wanted to talk about was about network thought. And this is something I know a lot of your work is based on. And you've talked about this idea of idea sex, which we'll go into in a second, and thinking in maps. So first of all, for someone who's never heard of this term, what does network thought mean, and why is it a tool that someone can use in their work?
There are three main types of thinking. The first one is linear thinking. That's when you just go A, then B. That's it. That's where lots of mistakes happen, because you fail to consider all of the other options. You just go from A to B without thinking much more about consequences, etc. The second type is second order thinking, where instead of just going straight from A to B, you consider potentially that there's another option, C, or that there could be second level consequences, etc. So instead of having the straight line, you start already having a bit more of, you know, a zigzagging road where you're navigating different ideas. And then network thinking is when things start looking more like a tree or a web, where you don't keep on moving forward. You can also go backward, connect one idea to several ideas together. And that gives you that thinking map that you can navigate to connect and combine ideas together.
So that's a great explanation. Thanks for sharing that. So these are what people might have used that in their learning, these mind maps that you might have seen, where you circle something and connect it to something else. The amazing thing is nowadays there's lots of software that's helping us do this in a much better way. One of those is Rome Research, which I know it seems like you're a fan of and you've been using. So for people who haven't heard of Rome, what is it and like how does it play into this kind of concept?
When thinking about specifically about network thinking, I think one of the big strengths of Rome is the concept of bidirectional links. So it means that when I take a note, I can link this note to other notes, but I can also see all of the notes that are linking back to this one. So going back to the concept of the thinking map, it really allows me to navigate the map in any direction and to connect ideas in any way that makes sense to me. So that's something I really like about Rome. It also actually has a page with a knowledge graph where you can visualize it. Mm. And to me, this is not necessarily the way I use it. I like looking at it because it's kind of cool to have this map of all of your ideas connected together. I use the links most often when I work with it. So that's one thing. The other thing that makes it really powerful compared to most traditional note-taking tools is that the atomic piece of content is not the page. It's something that's called the block. So each page, let's say I take notes about a book that I'm reading. I have a page for the book. And then under that page, I can have one block per idea that is mentioned in the book. And I can link those blocks together. So if I'm reading another book later, and I see that an idea in that book is linked to an idea from a previous book, I can connect these two together too. And that really allows you to create a granular map of ideas that you're thinking about yourself or that you're reading about from other authors.
I'm curious, like, is this how you primarily write nowadays, even for your blog and content you write for Twitter and stuff like that? Or is it more just a personal note-taking sort of application?
Bit of both. So first, yes, personal note-taking all happens in Rome. And for writing, I'm still not comfortable with the interface for actual proper writing, but I do all of my outlines in Rome. So I take ideas from different books, from different research, etc. I bring them together. I have the skeleton, and then I copy and paste the skeleton in a good old regular Google Doc. And this is where I do my writing.
I'm interested in how people like use different applications for their work. I also think people sometimes get overly complicated and they think it's all about the tool when really it's all about the work and the tool is there to help you. So for example, I had Tim Urban on the show, one of the best writers on the internet, and he uses text edit, like, you know, the plain thing, and he has like five of them open at the same time. Polina called Notion, like Google Docs with links or something like that, or with emojis. So it's just, you know, I agree. I think the best writers I've spoken to just focus on the writing and then use the tools where they can. But that's really interesting. The last point of that network thought, though, is the idea of idea sex. So what exactly does that mean?
It's more of a catchy expression to describe combinational creativity. And it's really just the idea of taking two or more ideas and let them have idea sex and make idea babies. So the point I'm trying to make when I talk about combinational creativity and idea sex is that lots of people still believe in the very old concept of the muse that is going to come and whisper new ideas into your ear. And you have to, you know, wait. And if you're lucky enough, like, she's going to visit you and tell you what to write about. If you look at the past in history, lots of poets and writers, etc., we're self-medicating to get the muse to visit them more often by drinking or taking opium. So a healthier way to think about creativity is to realize that all creativity is combinational in nature, and that any idea that you have is probably the result of two ideas that had sex together to give you that new one. So instead of waiting for it to happen, you can be a bit more proactive. And it's actually a really fun, playful thing to do sometimes, to take two ideas and think, okay, if they had a baby together, what would it look like?
Could you give an example of one that you've, where you've taken two ideas and put it together and maybe that ended up being a blog post or something like that?
And all of Nest Labs is about mindful productivity. I took mindfulness and productivity, brought them together. That's the best example I can give you, I think.
I love that. Yeah, okay. That's great. And I'm assuming you just picked those two because you're genuinely interested in both, or was there any more to it than that?
It emerged rather than I picked them. I started writing about things that I really liked. And then at some point I sat down and I tried to look at all of the articles that I had written. I think I was at about 50 articles at that point when I did that. And I started kind of looking at the themes that were emerging here. And I listed them on paper, and I had mental health, mindfulness, productivity, creativity, etc. And I did the idea sex exercise of, you know, okay, let's look at these. Is there something that could be an umbrella theme for everything that I write about? And in the end, mindful productivity to me also captured the creativity part, the mental health part, etc. So I felt like that was the best two ideas to have sex together.
I love that exercise of just like reflecting on what you've already been writing about. So maybe the first step is actually put pen to paper on stuff that you're thinking about, exploring, reading. And it's actually just a process I've noticed from the best guests on the podcast. A lot of them write in some way, even for themselves, because their thoughts are so much clearer. Even myself, like I've been writing for a long time, but like when I do write about, like, someone asked me recently how I get big guests on the show, and I was like, oh, I can just explain it. I sent them a voice note, but then I went and actually wrote it down, and I was like, oh, well, there's four main categories. Like, there's cold outreach, warm intros, one to many, and a fourth one. And it's just, it really solidifies the thought. So maybe I'll need to try out Rome to see if that helps me connecting them as well. We're going to run out of time soon. So the last thing I wanted to talk to you about was the happiness of theories of happiness in psychology, because I think this applies to everyone the same way learning does. And what I loved about this, I'll definitely link to the post so people can do kind of the deep dive, but the part that I'll like to focus on is really towards the end. You've got this like diagram with six different things on it, which has self-acceptance, autonomy, environmental mastery, personal growth, positive relations with others, and purpose in life. And I think a lot of this sounds kind of obvious, right? Like, yeah, of course we care about all of those things, but I really love the way that it was, like the harmony between those different parts really brings happiness. So maybe we can just go into a couple of those just to say, well, actually, before we do that, is that the kind of conclusion of like how you see the psychology of happiness?
So this is an older post, and this is really interesting that you're bringing it up, because for me, Nest Labs, that's why I call it labs. And I think this is why you call your creator lab as well, right?
It's always evolving.
Exactly. Learning, experimenting. And yes, I really still like this framework, and I think it has lots of meaning because it really helps you, you know, consider that happiness is not this kind of like big and attainable thing. It's actually made of some parts that you can pursue, either first individually, if you're getting started, if you're coming from a darker place and you just need a little baby step. Maybe you can start with self-acceptance, and then you can start, you know, with something else. So I really like this as a framework. I also feel like happiness is such a complex topic that it's impossible for a framework to capture exactly what it is. So yeah, I love frameworks. I think they're very helpful scaffolding for thinking. I also think it's important sometimes to acknowledge the fact that they're just a way to get started. And very often you do need to do a bit more digging to get to something that really captures the truth.
All of these are just like reference points to build on top of. And so again, if you're watching on YouTube, we'll share that diagram on the screen. And if you're not, if you're just listening, go to youtube.com/creatorlabfm. You'll be able to see that. But listen, we're running out of time now, and I've really enjoyed this. We've talked about so many amazing ideas. You'll see me in the Nest Labs community very soon, and I'm really glad we got to do this. Is there anywhere we should be sending people, or any final thoughts?
Yeah, just go to nestlabs.com/newsletter if you want to read more of my writing, or I saw you in the community with you as well.
Yeah, completely. I'll be in there talking as well. So let's definitely do that. Again, thanks so much. I'm hoping next time I'm in London or you're in New York, things will be a little calmer. We'll be able to get coffee and have a long conversation as well. But really appreciate this and excited to do this again in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.